Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable on this Wednesday morning. It's the 15th of July. Very nice to have you all with us. We welcome you to sit down, run, relax. I don't know. Whatever you're doing, you can listen to us in a myriad of ways. And all as long as you're comfortable and are hopefully enjoying the conversation. We have a great group to converse with. Let me introduce them to you. We also invite you, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We welcome WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, every day is a challenge, as we all know, and we got through yesterday, and now we're working on today.
That's right, and you're already 9 hours through it, and we'll just hope for the best, right?
It did start about 2 o'clock this morning.
Yeah,
been going since then.
Yeah, your hours may vary. That's true.
My hours do.
Yes. Well, good morning, and glad you are here. We welcome Times Union columnist Chris Churchill with us. Good morning, Chris. How are you? I didn't press the button, Chris. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, good morning. I'm glad for a second chance.
Yes. Aren't we all?
Exactly.
I like good morning followed by the real good morning. It's nice.
We call it rehearsal, Chris.
Yeah.
Also joining us this morning, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and the University at Albany, Bob Griffin is here. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Joe. And talking about a second chance, we're 111 days away from the election.
Oh, wow. Wow. And that, you know, that isn't long, really.
It seems very long to me.
Well, it does. I mean, it does. It does and it doesn't. I mean, if you think.
Think about it, Joe.
No.
This president could appoint two Supreme Court justices in that time. And with that phony Mitch McConnell, who said you could never do it within a year of a presidential thing, would vote for it standing on his head.
Absolutely. Yeah, he absolutely would.
Hold on. Don't say anything. Hold on. All right.
What happened?
A brief moment of silence for Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
What? What happened?
No, we just want to pray. We just want to pray.
Oh boy,
do we ever pray
with everything we've got.
No. No, we just want to give you a moment for your silent prayers.
Oh boy,
just scared the heck out of
me. No. I would never. First of all, I would be inconsolable if I had to report that news. Just know that. But also, I think, add it to your prayer chain, as we say in the Catholic Church. Rosemary Armeo, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well.
I'm listening to the show today while up on a chair cleaning cobwebs off my kitchen ceiling.
Well,
I've never done that during a radio show before.
Don't do that. Don't do that. It's too risky. We need you too much.
I'm glad to know you're giving us your complete concentration.
What did you say, Rosemary?
I'm very happy to be back on with Chris and Bob. I have not spoken with or at them in many, many days.
Did you leave somebody out?
No, Alan, I talk to you all the time.
No, I get
you
it.
You and Joe, I've talked to. You get it?
Got it.
Not always about you, Alan.
Oh, boy.
And Rosemary, Chris and I both have missed you terribly. In fact, we've been emailing worried about you. So I'm looking forward to speaking
sure
with you again
I'm
today.
Sure.
Well, the gang is back together, and we couldn't be more thrilled. So let us get started. A reminder, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we welcome your letters. All right, so we'll start with the story that we actually touched on yesterday. I know something this is, and I know last week, Bob, the last time you were on, Bob, we talked about this with you, about the plan on visas for international students. That plan has been rescinded. They wanted to strip visas from international students at online classes. The Trump administration said it would no longer require foreign students to attend in-person classes during the coronavirus pandemic in order to remain in the country. That is new. This comes after a lot of really yelling and screaming and lawsuits from key universities and colleges across this country. Alan, what do you make of it?
Well, when you tick off Harvard and MIT, you really are going to the head of the class. there will be those who disagree. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, New Paltz is better than Harvard and MIT, but there might be a few who disagree with that. nevertheless, I said earlier today, and I truly believe, that Trump, even if they had to pull back, Trump got what he wanted. Again, another message to the base we want the others out of here. And even if the others have never been in that home country or the rest of it, we want them out of here. And message received. And so what if he doesn't get what he theoretically wanted? He was really what we call narrow casting to the base.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, I agree. I also think it's important to remember, too, that the tech companies actually came out against this policy, as well as a number of states. I agree with Alan. It was a typical Stephen Miller policy. It was aimed to hurt and embarrass rather than actually enforce any sense of decent American policy. Joe, I'd like to say the country did the right thing. I think it didn't. I think changing the policy was a good thing, but I don't think the reason that was changed was anything other than the economics of it.
Yeah.
And when they started to look at how badly economies would be hurt because of the lack of international students, I think that's probably what drove the chain. And if I could toss one thing at the folks at home to think about, when we start to talk about international students, it's not just about the money they bring in or the richness that they bring to a campus like the University of Albany. This is a critical part of our diplomacy, of how we actually take students in. They get a chance to live in the United States, to interact with us, and they generally go back to their home countries not only sympathetic but huge supporters of who we are and what we stand for, and that's an incredibly important part of the future of our future diplomacy.
Rosemary.
Oh, hogwash to all of that. I don't think it was mentioned for debate. I think it was a Stephen Miller plan, and he absolutely wanted it to go into effect, and I don't think he's given up on it. But as usual, witness the Muslim travel ban and several other of his efforts, it was done halfway. It was done incompetently and badly lawyered, and I think they knew that they would lose the legal challenges that were coming. They couldn't even enforce it in the fall. But as to their thinking it was just for the base or just a PR move, nope. I think they really wanted to do it. The economy they would have hurt, Bob, would be that of universities. And they're no friends to higher education either. So if universities had been hurt, those liberal bastions and breeding grounds, that would have been just as fine to them as hurting immigrants. And the same for soft diplomacy, which you're describing. Trump has no regard for hard diplomacy. Why would he want to preserve the soft diplomacy? Baloney.
That's what you missed, wasn't it, Bob and Chris?
Yeah.
Well, that ended quickly.
I call double BS on Rosemary. The fact is, I never said that they didn't want it. I said it's just as good for them that they tried to do it, even if they failed. That's why I call double BS.
A triple dog dare against Rosemary. Rosemary, I can't disagree with much of what you said, but what I was saying was that folks at home need to understand how important international students are, not only to the economy, not only to our universities, but also to our diplomacy. That's all I'm saying. I wasn't trying to put words in Stephen Miller's mouth, although I wish I could.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think diplomacy of all sorts are in danger under a Trump administration. But I don't think we've seen the last of this. I think we've seen, just like he's come back with the travel ban, he's come back now. He's claiming he's going to soon have a new plan for the Dreamers. I'm sure it'll be horrible. I think we're going to see more on restricting immigrants coming in to study.
Chris Churchill.
Well, we haven't mentioned the context in which the policy was announced, which was his desire to get the economy reopened in the fall, despite the coronavirus, right? I mean, this was about ordering these schools or twisting their arms to fully open when many of them don't really want to do so. I mean, it was the aim was to hit them financially if they didn't fully reopen. But I mean, I think almost everybody agreed that it was a bad policy. It was using these students kind of as pawns for a greater goal that, you know, the Trump administration has. And almost everybody was against it. I mean, a lot of Republicans in Congress were against it. The business community was against it. I think even immigration hardliners aren't really particularly upset about, you know, international college kids. There just was no constituency for this, and they were going to lose in court. So, it was kind of probably embarrassing for them to have to reverse it so quickly, but it was kind of obvious that they were going to have to. And, you know, as far as the playing to the base, it's kind of an interesting dynamic going on right now because, you know, as Rosemary mentioned, Trump keeps promising some sort of executive action on the Dreamers and on DACA and on immigration. We don't really know what that will be. He keeps telling us it's going to be huge and big and wonderful and all these things. But it is interesting. I don't know how they're going to balance the demands of the base with their desire to get Hispanics to vote for Trump. I think he has been making a play for the Hispanic vote, and I think he's going to continue to do so. I think that's one of the few ways that he can win states that he has to win, like Arizona and Texas and some other states.
Rosemary?
Chris is right about the context, and that is true. As for his DACA deal, I don't think it's going to be good news for the Dreamers. He is in play even in Texas, which has never happened before. He's so close. So it'll be awful. It'll just be awful.
I don't get the Texas remark. Would you just clarify that for me? So Texas is in play. The Democrats look like they theoretically could take it. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant. Trump is in trouble in places he never has been before, if polls are to be believed, although yesterday's primary results make me think that he's as stronger than those polls indicate. And I think he's reserving the right to come out with some plan that will put the Dreamers in their place, which is he does not believe is in the United States.
If you look at the polls, Joe Biden is outperforming Hillary in almost every category, with one big exception. He's not doing as well with Hispanic voters. There's been a kind of a little bit of a shift toward Trump among Hispanic voters, and Biden isn't engaging them as well as Hillary apparently did. So, I mean, that is one
opportunity. Explain that to me.
I don't really have an explanation.
I do.
Yeah, I don't. Go ahead.
Go, Alan.
I think there'll be people that don't like this, but I think it is true that he senses that there may be some distance between black people in America and brown people in America, and he wants to exacerbate that. That's what I think is happening.
Yeah, and it's also Biden just hasn't done well with Hispanic voters for a while. I mean, Bernie crushed Biden among Hispanic voters too. The Biden campaign just does not seem to be connecting with the Hispanic community that well. Go ahead, Rosemary.
No. I didn't have anything. You answered the question.
She was just going after a cobweb.
Cobwebs are gone. What is it that Trump is offering the Latino vote that Biden is not? I just don't get it. But then we have a whole record in this country of voting against our own self-interest. So.
Before we got on, I looked at the poll numbers, and you know, Biden was up about 50% versus 41.3% for the president, but Texas was only separated between the two of them by about 1 percentage point. So I mean, that does sort of play into everything that we were just talking about, and I'll be honest, I'm still puzzled at the Hispanic support of a Trump administration, particularly after he has been so overtly racist towards the Hispanic community.
Well, I should clarify a little bit. I mean, it's not that Trump is winning Hispanics. Biden still wins the Hispanic vote decisively. He's just underperforming. He's doing you know, I think it's like 10 or 15 points.
Less well than Hillary.
It's narrower than it was for Hillary Clinton. So it's not that Hispanics have shifted to Trump in any sort of really dramatic way. It's just that there is a little window there where, you know, Trump could make some progress. And I think, you know, he's been doing that. He had that Hispanic, I'm not exactly sure what it was called, but initiative last week that the Goya CEO got into hot water over. And, you know, he's, again, keeps mentioning this thing he's going to do in immigration. So I think it's kind of clear that he's bidding for that vote.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Rosemary.
I would say, I agreeing with Chris, he also had the Mexican president here who was remarkably close to Trump, considering his comments about Mexicans coming into this country all being rapists and drug dealers.
I know that I've been pretty well ignored on this question, but if Trump is is playing the race card in order to win among whites, what makes you think he won't do that among Hispanics?
Yeah,
you know, Alan, I think you're onto something. I assume that he will. I mean, I think it's just a matter of time, to be honest.
I think
with
he
you.
Is.
Particularly as his numbers continue to go down, I think he's going to get more and more outrageous. I mean, we saw that whole fiasco in the Rose Garden yesterday. I mean,
will you remind everybody what happened?
Well, he had an announcement.
Go ahead, Rosemary. We only have about 30 seconds.
No, I can shut up. It was supposed to be an announcement in the Rose Garden, which is a place where historic and huge, big, wonderful American initiatives have traditionally been announced. And it turned into a disjointed, a confusing stream of consciousness rant against Biden. It was crazy.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we love to hear from you. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo are all on the panel this morning. We'll continue our conversation with them after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Robert Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo making up the panel. A couple of letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. Diane says, I fully agree with Rosemary. Also, since Trump was elected, he has been targeting the Dreamers. These young people have been stressed and wondering what their fate is. Just another example of Trump's cruelty. Also, we go to Susan, who says, as usual, the administration made another poorly thought out vindictive dictum, causing a lot of commotion, confusion, and stress. And then it experienced pushback and threats. The administration rescinded it. We go to Amy, who said, a battle between the University of Massachusetts administration and the town of Amherst is brewing about how to control students who pose a major health threat to everyone in this town and within 20 miles. Any ideas how a university can enforce social distancing among a student body of 35,000? And this, of course, comes from our discussion about overall about the point Chris was making of the context of the stories and the visas of bringing schools back and bringing students back in the fall, both to grade school as well as to higher learning centers.
Joe, if I could jump in on that one.
Sure.
I think the writer is hitting on I think what's going to be an incredibly difficult thing to do. You know, I can tell you that universities are looking at social distancing, but it means that there's not going to be adequate classroom space. They're looking at being able to do both in person and in hybrid online courses, but you lose some of the richness of it. And the social distancing, I think, becomes even more complicated because we're sort of working against, you know, human nature when we're expecting 18-year-olds
what do you mean?
We're expecting 18
I know what you mean.
Okay. Well, I didn't know, Alan. I was going to have the talk with you offline if we needed to. But
don't steal that from us. If that happens, that's on the radio, buddy.
We're done.
And it will be awesome the one time I could do it. I think this is going to be an enormously challenging time for higher education, but also the communities that are dependent upon higher education as well. So this is something that we're going to continue to struggle with. And I would imagine what we start with or what we believe we're going to start with in August is not going to be what we end with in November or December.
You know, on the other hand, just let me just say that if you're the Governor Baker of Massachusetts, why not just say, okay, everybody wears a mask, including every student, or it's going to cost you $2,000. What's wrong with that?
I thought Governor Cuomo was brilliant last week. I really do. I think it's reasonable, and I think we explained to people why we're putting policies in place. And if this is the quote sacrifice you need to make in order to continue your education and continue to be able to operate as a community, it doesn't seem like it's the biggest sacrifice that we could make.
Rhonda says, I'm with Alan on the racist motivation. I already see social media posts by black friends saying not all people of color are united with Black Lives Matter. There are historic tensions among groups and between immigrant groups and African Americans who can look down on whom. Then there is this from Susan. Rosemary is completely right that Trump's plan about international students is to hurt higher education. A few nights ago on Fox News' Life, Liberty, and Levin, Levin interviewed Dr. Thomas Sowell on Sowell's new book on charter schools. They both were referring to public schools as government schools, and the curriculum is indoctrination. Sowell was almost apoplectic about how higher ed has changed since he was teaching in the 1960s, that colleges and universities have become liberal hotbeds of disinformation that is trying to tear down the country. Every time I watch Fox, I'm worried about how many people watch Fox for their news. So many lies and disinformation. Alan, since you have spent so many years in a liberal hotbed of disinformation, what do you make of that?
Well, it's a very interesting letter. It really is. I once had to go to bat for somebody in a department in a college who was not a Marxist. The department had many Marxists and one who was not. And they tried to ride her out and get rid of her during that time. And reason prevailed, and I worked hard on it. I can only say that you have to be very careful that colleges don't self-select into the point where there isn't enough room for all sides.
Rosemary?
About the Fox News program that the writer was talking about, it's baloney. Back in the 60s, they were still considered, even then, a hotbed of liberalism, and all the professors supposedly were provoking us students into demonstrating against the government, when actually it was horrible policies in Vietnam. So there's nothing new in this. What is new is the power of the movement. I'm really distressed at what's happening on college campuses, not just shutting down liberal voices, which might be my own, I worry about that, but also shutting down conservative voices, students who feel unsafe or don't want conservative speakers on campus. We've spoken about that before. Both are violations of freedom of speech and an openness to new ideas, and I think it's really disturbing to see it on campuses.
Hey, the New York Times just did that, Rosemary. You remember, wasn't that long ago?
I know, that's such a, yeah, it's true. And it's going on now. We might have that on the media project with a top opinion editor leaving because she was bullied for having opinions different than her colleagues.
Oh, I want to talk about that story. That's
there goes the cuckoo clock.
Well, I was reading that story.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's my...
Oh, that's the phone.
That's the soundtrack of your life, Rosemary. Is that what you just said?
I don't know. Somehow,
my
Rosemary.
My cuckoo clock, and it doesn't tell the right time. So, I mean, it may be banging out 12 o'clock in another minute or two. I'm not sure.
Well, Rosemary denies it, but every time I speak, the cuckoo goes off.
Pure coincidence.
pure coincidence. All right. As far as the where were we going? We wanted to talk about the New York Times. I would like to delve into that story for a moment. I didn't have it on our docket today, but I was reading about it this morning. And, of course, the New York Post has it on their front page. But Barry Weiss resigns from the New York Post, from the New York Times opinion post, saying there was bullying by colleagues over her views. And, of course, it's the two places where you find the most information on this is the is the New York Times. They've covered themselves as well as Fox News and New York Post. So, but reading from the Washington Post, Barry Weiss, who attracted considerable controversy both internally and externally, resigned from the newspaper, according to the company yesterday. In a lengthy note about her Monday departure, Weiss criticized the Times for caving to the whims of critics on Twitter and for not standing up for her after she said she was bullied by Times staffers. The paper of record is more and more the record of those living in a distant galaxy, one whose concerns are profoundly removed from the lives of most people, she wrote. Nowadays, standing up for the principal at the paper does not win plaudits. It puts a target on your back. She came to the Times in 2017 from the Wall Street Journal as part of former opinions editor James Bennett's vision to show the many sides, many shades of conservatism, and many shades of liberalism. Rosemary, your concerns on this, and then I'd like to hear from Alan and,
Chris. I actually want to hear Chris too. Chris, maybe you should go first. You're another opinion writer too. I have no opinions as anyone who listens to this show knows. So, what do you make of this?
Well, that's good, Chris. If people should go right to the source. They should read her resignation letter, which you can find online, and it's pretty searing and pretty scathing and pretty disturbing. I mean, you know, Barry Weiss is not some sort of crazy right winger. She's not. She's not Tom Cotton. She's not. I mean, she's a moderate person, and she's saying that there's no room for even moderation at the Times at this point. That it's either you get on, you know, the woke train or you're pushed off. She said, you know, that
she describes herself as a centrist.
Yeah, she's a centrist, but she is somebody
on the side of the Cotton editorial running, right?
I'm not sure about that. I would assume so, but I'm not entirely sure about that. I mean, we should, you know, the context is there's this kind of bigger upheaval going on in the Times opinion section because they ran that Tom Cotton essay. You know, a lot of the day-to-day reporters and staffers at the Times are really upset about that op-ed running. But I think, you know, the Times kind of has a tradition of running pieces that liberal America doesn't necessarily agree with. It has a tradition of challenging people, which I think is a good thing. I think people do need to get their assumptions challenged, and that you do need to have an understanding of what the other side is thinking. And I think it's a really bad trend if every news outlet becomes in essence Fox News or MSNBC, where it's 100% one way or the other. You know, I think that's dangerous.
If I could jump in, I agree with
go ahead.
I agree with both of you, and I could tell you from my own history, I think one of the most remarkable speeches that I've ever heard was by William Buckley when I was at UMass Amherst back in the 80s. And it's not that I agree with a lot of his politics, but it was just so interesting to hear his take and his position. And I think it's actually critical that all institutions of higher education provide our students with a multitude of ideas and approaches, and give them the tools to make up their own mind. And I'm really disappointed in the Times. I think it was part of their sort of moral responsibility to publish Cotton's manifesto, and it's part of their responsibility to try to show us all of these different slices of how people in America think. It's a bad precedent.
Do you think that there's a certain amount of hypocrisy I don't want to put words in your mouth, in the announcement that many of the Times staff felt endangered by that opinion. Cotton's
opinion.
We talked about it on the media project, and I remember saying, I don't get it. I would have run the column. I went through it twice after the Times came out and said it didn't meet our standards. And I can't see what standards it didn't meet. So I'm saying this must be a sign that I'm ready to retire, that there's a new ethos of thinking about these sorts of things, and I'm not into it. So it was somewhat heartening for me to hear from Weiss, who said, look, I've looked at other editorials that we've done that have been just as one-sided and slanted. That's what an op-ed is. It isn't a balanced editorial journalistic project. It's an opinion piece. And she's right about it. But I also fault her for giving up. She's there to counter exactly the sort of bullying nonsense that she's calling out. Instead, she just hurts the Times and she's left. So who's going to be the counter now?
Exactly the kind of thing, Rosemary, that I know you'll agree with me that we talk about with Fauci, you know, the idea that he should stay and fight the good fight that you're saying.
Yeah.
Don't you see what you see what I did there? Okay. Okay.
Rather brilliantly, I would say. Go ahead.
No. He thinks he caught me, and he did not. Government is not the same as a liberal newspaper in the United States.
But if she's being bullied and she is miserable, and I don't know this to be the case, but certainly I agree with Chris that if you read, you know, it's a scathing letter that she writes, and you know she's just has a pit in her stomach every morning going to work. Then yeah, why do that?
By the way, it doesn't only happen at newspapers. It happens in other places, too. I have people who, in reading what's going on in WNYC, for example, in New York, there is a certain political correctness. You know, if you listen to WAMC and you listen to the commentators we have some pretty right-wing people, I'll tell you right now, and they're constant. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it sometimes we tend to blame the institutions, and I do think the New York Times has a lot to answer for when you look at her claims of not just bullying, but also some anti-Semitism and just kind of general intolerance for diversity of opinion that she's saying exists at the Times. But you do have to blame the audience, too. I mean, the Times is, in a way, responding to what its readers want. And every time the Times does print, you know, either a headline that isn't condemning of Trump or an op-ed like Cotton's, they do get a tremendous amount of pushback from readers, at least online. I mean, that's maybe only a small segment of the people who actually read the paper who are on Twitter. But they do get a lot of pushback from people who don't want to have their assumptions challenged or their opinions challenged or don't want to read the other side. So, you know, it's when the Times prints something that is conservative, it's almost like they're giving their readers a little dose of spinach, you know, to swallow. And a lot of times the readers just don't want it.
Well, that's how they took the Cotton story. Readers took that, and staffers took it as we're endorsing Tom Cotton's stupid idea to send troops in to put down legal protests. The whole idea seems to be lost about you listen to both sides, even if you disagree to it, and you answer back. But she's done that, too. I mean, she's an opinion writer. She should have. I mean, why doesn't she glory in the fact that she's provoking people?
And of course,
not everybody can be Laura Ingraham.
And of course, we don't really fully understand the extent of what was really going on there. Right. I mean,
a yucky person. She might just be someone, and the anti-Semitism she felt and the bullying might be just because she's, you know, hard to take.
Or it could be real.
We don't know.
Right.
Or it could be
real. We don't know the internal dynamic, but her boss was, I mean, the person who hired her was also just fired, right? So she may not have felt supported there anymore. We don't know the internal dynamics there, but I've never heard anybody say anything negative about Barry Weiss's personality. I do know that some people find that she, you know, on Israeli politics, she can be a little bit intolerant of people who support Palestine, and that might have something to do with this. But you know, again, I don't really know the internal dynamic.
The
but
wonder,
in, but in her, in, Yeah, go ahead.
The wonderful, thank you. The wonderful Michael Bowen is yelling in my ear that it's time to go to a break.
Yep,
we're about 6 minutes late. So he is doing his job to make sure that I eventually do mine. We go to a break. We come back and we'll continue this conversation. Very good one. We have many letters on it as well. We'll get to those right after this. Some very cool music that we're playing this morning is Rodney Allen Greenblatt, is a musician and visual artist and has an exhibition at Hudson Hall in Hudson, which is entitled Something to Look Forward to. I was listening to him yesterday. He was speaking with Sarah LaDuke on our A Face for Radio video series, which is on the Instagram, WAMC's Instagram feed, so you can go to that and see the interview. It's really fascinating stuff, but the music is great, and you can see the entire playlist by going to wamc.org/roundtable. You can also go to hudsonhall.org, hudsonhall.org, to find out information about the exhibition. They have a timed entry policy, but it's just good to know that museums are open. We're going to be talking to Mass Mocha's Joe Thompson later on today as well. So some art is returning, and that is wonderful news. But again, Rodney Allen Greenblatt providing the music this morning. All right, let's go to some letters if we can, and we go to Brucey, who says there are reports that Barry Weiss tried to get other people fired, tried hard. Also, unless I'm mistaken about what an opinion writer does, I don't think she goes into work every day. I think she writes 2 columns a month and gets paid handsomely for it. I thought her letter was exceptionally whiny.
Well, she's an opinion editor. She's not. She doesn't have a regular column. She does write occasionally. And when she does write, it's usually a pretty interesting piece. But she's an opinion editor. Her job was to gather opinions from a range of voices. That's what she was brought on to do. And her complaint is that she's being stymied in doing that, that the Times no longer wants the range of voices that she was brought in to bring on. You know, the larger context is, you know, she was hired. And a lot of people at the Times are hired after the 2016 election, when the Times editors just kind of woke up and realized that Donald Trump was president and that the Times had kind of lost touch with the country. So there was just kind of this internal kind of conversation about, you know, trying to understand America a little bit better and trying to bring in a greater diversity of voices. I don't know if the newspaper has abandoned that, but it, you know, there does seem to be kind of a move away from that. And that's what Barry Weiss really calls out in that resignation letter.
Chris, could you just do me a favor? Can you just say a couple words about what an editor does in the newsroom? Like, did she have ultimate authority of what to publish or to recommend to give people a sense of the scope?
Every newsroom works a little bit differently. I mean, The Times has a lot more people than any newsroom I've ever worked for, so they have a lot more layers. It was in my understanding that her job was to just kind of commission work and to try to reach. She talks a little bit in the letter about all, you know, the kind of people that she has gotten into the paper, but she expresses frustration that if there is a piece that is not necessarily conservative, but just doesn't go along with the kind of heterodoxy orthodoxy that it's edited in a different way than a piece that everybody agrees with, right? That it's held to a much higher standard. And I think you can probably see that with the Cotton essay. I mean, I think there are a lot of liberal pieces in the Times that have the same sort of factual problems that the Cotton piece did, but you don't see the same sort of uproar. You agree with that, Rosemary?
She made that a point in her letter. I will say that the assignment editor position that she has is one of the most frustrating jobs in all of professionalism. You have no real power. You get crap. Can I say that? Crap from the people below you who you're
sounds
working
like being
with.
A dean.
And then the people above you. Yeah. And then the people above you stomp on you too. And as Chris pointed out, her boss did get fired over the Cotton article. So in a way, the letter isn't whiny so much as just vengeful. It hurts the Times. Fox and right-wing media is just having a blast with this, which is not something that the media needed. I recognize that she has no obligation to protect mainstream media, but she's done a grievous body blow to it.
Alan?
Well, you know, there's so much to be said, and we say a lot of it on the Media Project. And, you know, Rosemary and Rex and the gang know much more about this than I do. But it is interesting that the Times is still the Times. The Washington Post is still the Washington Post. Every discussion you ever have say that when everything else is gone, those papers will be there. Now, here in Berkshire County, I have to be very careful because I'm sometimes criticized for this. You see, you know, headlines that don't agree with the first paragraph. You see, you know, other stuff. And that has to do with money. And we're always talking about money. But in this case, the Times is flush. They've got plenty. They didn't for a little while there. But they've got plenty of money, right? And that brings with it its own set of problems. I just don't like bullying, and I really do believe the conservative point of view, as much as I disagree with it, ought to be played.
Yeah, and again, Barry Weiss isn't a conservative. I mean, she describes herself as a moderate. You know, she did come over from the Wall Street Journal, which obviously has a very conservative opinion page. But I've never. You know, I've heard Barry Weiss describe herself as a liberal. She may mean a classical liberal on shows like, you know, Bill Maher or Joe Rogan's podcast. But, you know, even her willingness to go on a podcast like Joe Rogan's, which, you know, is the most popular podcast in America, earned her a lot of criticism from people who said that she shouldn't be talking to people who don't, you know.
Exactly.
Who don't. Think
well, again,
the way that,
she didn't just
that
go
they
on
want
the
them
show.
To think.
She didn't just, Chris, she didn't just go on the show. She wrote a whole column about how Rogan represents the new mainstream media in the United States. And that's what earned her the criticism. Again, I think there's something personality-wise in this. She likes stirring up things, which is, I think, great in an opinion writer or editor.
Me too.
But
me too.
In this case, she doesn't, she didn't want, you know, she fought back in a kind of mean way, I think.
Well, you know, the thing about I love about you, Rosemary, is that you take opinions that quite frequently are, you know, not acceptable to many of our friends. And I consider myself to the left of center, but way to the left of center. And they let you know it, and they let you know it fast and hard and painfully sometimes, so that, you know, people who are always talking about the need for freedom of expression don't necessarily mean it.
Yeah, they don't follow.
And that's a real problem, Alan, because what it does is that it further cements the echo chambers that we've started to divide ourselves into. And I think this is a huge issue on college campuses that we need to continue to be an open platform for a multitude of ideas, and groupthink, I think, is incredibly dangerous to the founding beliefs of this country.
It always worked. I'll go real fast, Joe. It always works both ways. When I was at Hunter College, they didn't want to let Norman Thomas. They didn't want to let Norman Thomas speak. So that was one direction. Now we're going in another.
With that, let's take a break. We have a lot more to talk about and a wonderful panel to do so. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, Rosemary Armeo. First, news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. And yes, we welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. Letters like this from John, who says, I believe we are in for a protracted culture war, violent or not. This is a war that will leave no one in the political middle. What is happening at the New York Times, et cetera, is the hardening of positions for this struggle. Was New York newspapers carrying both sides' opinion during the Civil War? No, they chose sides. Anyone on that?
Well, I mean, I don't know if we're headed for a cultural civil war. I hope that we're not. But it is true that, you know, American newspapers and newspapers in other countries did used to take one side or the other. And, you know, the Times has always been a liberal newspaper, but it's just that it has been willing to publish opinions that the majority of staffers probably disagree with at times. And I think that's a good tradition. I think there's value in that.
Rosemary or Alan, anyone on that?
I pass to Rosemary.
Yeah, okay. It should. Well, Chris is right. It's a historical thing in the United States that newspapers were partisan. You picked one side or another and you read it. And very much then we went to a period in the 20th century where there was mass circulation of newspapers mostly. So there was more of an effort then to provide all kinds of points of view. But very much we are going back to the old tradition of partisan press. You don't get a full view if you're only reading the New York Times and listening to MSNBC. You've got to look at Fox. You have to even read God Help Us All, Breitbart. And that goes back. I don't know if newspapers, if the media was ever really successful at that, you know, a completely objective point of view. I don't think we were, but it puts the onus on citizens who have to work harder at getting the news and figuring out where the real truth is, where the balance is.
And in the New York Times lecture.
Go ahead.
In the New York Times' defense, they do still, if you read the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal, for example, or the New York Post, it's 100% conservative. And the Times still does run quite a few conservative opinions. They have conservative columnists. They probably have a much greater range of diversity of opinion now than they've ever had. I mean, they have a socialist who is pro-life as a columnist right now. I mean, that, you know, they have a heterodoxy that they never... You know, back in the supposed golden days of the Times, you had columnists who were a little bit to the right and a little bit to the left. And I think now there's a fuller range of opinion, and I do hope that continues.
We have many letters on this. Rosemary, do you want to say something before we go to those? I guess not. Rosemary?
Rosemary just confronted a
child. Well, okay.
I thought she fell off the stool.
Me too.
I was going to say she confronted a gigantic spider.
She'd been webbed.
I regret telling you what I was doing. You know, I think what's different, Chris, is something you pointed out before. It's not that there didn't used to be a diversity of opinion, and it wasn't before as if the staff didn't like some of it. But now they have influence. Like, I just thought that was ridiculous that the staffers expressed their dismay and the response was to fire the editor and obviously upset other members of the staff who supported Bennett. And I have been reading that as I'm out of touch, like I'm old school. But now that I see this happening and I see the debate again and the letter that Weiss wrote, it makes me wonder if it isn't just a failing. Who cares what staffers' individual opinions are? It's up to the newspaper editors to set the policy of the newspaper.
Apparently not.
Decide who's going to run. Yeah, apparently not. Is that a good thing?
Well, we've been talking about the opinion side of things, but there is something, you know, I think if you read the Times, you can see opinion bleeding more and more into the news coverage. I think more and more.
I've been saying that for years and getting crap for doing it. But it is. I mean, you can tell. You see, she's gone and done it again. As soon as I begin to talk, we hear the cuckoo.
That was timed beautifully. Okay. Go on, Alan.
No, I mean, look, the Times is the greatest newspaper in the country, maybe the world. It is an extraordinary enterprise, and we've got to be thankful that we have it. I read it 3 times in the middle of the night. Nevertheless, you know, they do some things that drive me nuts in terms of, you know, their letters policies. I could go into this in great detail. Their letters policies, you can always tell, okay, we're going to take, you know, the nutty one and put it in just to show how stupid people can be on a different side. On the assignments policy, you know, they have what could be considered an S list, you know, people who don't appear in the Times, that kind of thing. It's not always pretty.
I want to get to just a couple of these letters on this issue, and then we'll move on to other stuff here. But we go to Lynn, who says, I have to speak up here. We can't have reasonable debate when the president is burning down the House. The Times has the responsibility to counter the president. Look, you have the Cotton story that advocates sending in the troops to put down the people. Reasonable people totally disagree with this. Hello, 1932, when the media was being removed for claiming stormtroopers were putting down protesters.
Then so the ends justify the means. In other words, if Trump is bad, which he is, terrible, therefore, the Times has an obligation to be on the other side and not to report what Trump said and let people make assessments of their own about it. I mean, it just doesn't fly.
We have a letter from Adam who has a subject line that says, "Cry me a river, Barry." I am an insider in the organized Jewish professional world for over a decade. Barry Weiss has been one of the most strident silencers and cancelers within the organized Jewish community for many years. Her arrogance and condescension knows no bounds. Her public resignation is simply a publicity stunt to promote her new book, which would be better titled, Do You Disagree With Me? Then... we go to Mary, who says, if the professional communicators of the New York Times can't communicate, then what hope is there for bridging the communication chasm among the rest of us in this country? That is a great question, I think, for Mary.
I mean, you know, what we're talking about kind of is, yeah, go ahead.
Good.
No, go on, Chris. No, Chris, go ahead. I'll jump in after you.
I mean, what we're talking about kind of more broadly is what the people call the cancel culture and this kind of attack on free speech. And the problem, whenever anybody criticizes the cancel culture, a lot of times you find out that they are perfectly willing to participate in the cancel culture. They just disagree about who should be canceled. And I think that's kind of what the letter writer was saying about Barry Weiss and her kind of positions on BDS and on Palestinian rights. The only thing I would be more willing to dismiss Weiss's resignation letter, though, if this wasn't echoing what we've heard from a lot of other people, too, about, not just about the Times, but about, you know, other publications, other kind of mainstream liberal media publications, and also, you know, like college campuses. I mean, this is something that's happening in the culture more broadly. This isn't Barry Weiss alone who's making this complaint.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, and Joe, it's a little. I worry a little bit when you get a letter like that, because she could be a completely unlikable person, but that doesn't mean that she's not competent and good at her job. I really do think that, you know, going back to Chris's great comments about the cancel culture, is that's what we're starting to conflate a lot of different issues. The tendency is to chop off the head first rather than to have a conversation. I just worry that I also laugh because I think about myself I think about my poor faculty who you know, they're given the hour of the day or the day of the week probably can't stand me. But you know, still sort of put up with me. So if having to win a popularity contest is going to be part of all of our jobs, a lot of us are in real trouble.
Yeah. You know, and Barry talks about in that resignation letter about how the press used to see its job as informing people to let people make up their own conclusions. And more, in her view at least, and I somewhat agree with this, you read a lot of stories where you kind of feel as though you're being told what to think, you know, and I do think it's, you know, to use a kind of a bad word, problematic, or, you know, a word I don't like.
All right. Let's, I think I have one more letter here, if I can find it, and then we'll move on to other topics. Joel says we're already deep into, he was responding to an earlier letter saying that we're headed toward a cultural civil war. And Joel says we're already deep into it. We are waist deep in the Big Muddy, and the Orange Fool and his cult will keep pushing on.
Yay, Pete.
Then John says Barry Weiss is criticized not because she's a conservative centrist, but because she's so often wrong. Also, check her history of trying to silence those who disagree with her. There is no dearth of conservative voices on the Times op-ed page, unless you discount Brooks, Stevens, and all the guest columnists. Robert says, you are correct for all voices to be heard until fascist behavior on one side or the other stifles free speech. A healthy democracy can withstand dissent. It's a signpost when there are no different opinions. And finally, I think Francis says, following on from the Barry Weiss discussion, I'm a raving liberal, but I actually miss having a wider range of political views in your discussions. I want to hear from conservatives who disagree with me. I'm British. I used to work for the BBC. You have to maintain political balance overall by law. I think there's a lot to be said for that. It enables us to hear a wide range of views. That from Francis. Okay, let's move on to other topics and find out what else is making news here. Of course, we talk about the coronavirus and several aspects of that. And what we do know is that there is a global surge in the coronavirus. It is being fed by the developing world and the United States of America. So far this week, the planet has added an average of more than 200,000 cases every day. The coronavirus, once concentrated in specific cities or countries, has now crept into virtually every corner of the globe and is wreaking havoc in multiple major regions at once. Poorer nations throughout Latin America, the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa are bearing a growing share of the caseload. And then there's the United States, which leads the world in new cases and, as with many nations that possess far fewer resources, has shown no sign of being able to rein control. Nearly all the countries struggling with the surge share something in common. After weeks or months of trying to suppress the virus, they reopen their economies, only to find that the virus came roaring back. Now they are using a more limited arsenal to contain the spread with little success. That from the Washington Post. Alan?
Well, look, we have a president who could cure a good deal of this, which would put a stop to a good deal of this. We are told by people like Fauci and others that if he just said everybody wears a mask or you get a $2,000 fine, and everybody did, and the virus numbers would go down dramatically. But he can't do that because it runs in the face of his winning re-election. The virus, we know how to put a stop to it, but we just won't do it because we have inept, I think, corrupt political leadership.
Bob, I know you're all over this.
Oh God, yeah, and you know it's, and if you look at the numbers, they're staggering, particularly in places like Oklahoma and Wyoming right now. It's not just the Californias, Texas, and Floridas, and it's also, we're seeing not only a resurgence of coronavirus, we're also seeing a return to not enough testing, not enough personal protective equipment, but at the same time, we have a whole bunch of people who are taking this as a partisan political issue. And I'll point to everybody to the comments that were made out of Orange County, where their school board voted to reopen all schools with no social distancing in order to, quote, be brave, unquote.
And I think
Alan's absolutely correct, is that, you know, that what Fauci and others were saying all the way along is that you got to make a sacrifice, but the sacrifice are things like you get a social distance, you got to wear a mask, you got to wash your hands. If you don't feel well, you got to stay home. There's some really basic things that could have been done to head off the resurgence of this virus. I've said it before on the show, I'll say it again. I think that people like Abbott and the governor from Florida and the governor from Georgia, that they're criminally negligent for allowing their communities to reopen the way they did, and they are responsible for the spread of this sort of new wave of spread.
But as a political scientist, let me ask you this then: do you think, based on what you've just said, which I think is correct, that the ultimate Democratic sanction, which is votes, will go against them in those places because they haven't behaved the way they ought to in order to put a stop to it?
Yeah, I do. I think there's going to be huge ramifications at the polling place, particularly as the deaths continue to increase, and everybody gets excited about reopening, Alan, and then all of a sudden you're forced to close again. That's almost worse than just continuing on with the sacrifice. So
even
yeah, I think there's going to
even in Alabama.
Well, that you know, I'm not smart enough to figure out what the hell's going on down Alabama. I guess I'd have to go talk to a failed football coach in order to figure that out. But I think in most places, I think there is going to be a reckoning for elected officials who have not performed their required leadership function.
Could be in some places. You know, I think in Maine it may happen, but there are some of those states that come directly out of Dixie, if you're following me, and have never changed, not since that time. I mean, this was so alarming.
Rosemary, you're going to say?
If I can add one other element to this, we're talking just about the United States. I remember back in March saying, oh, my gosh, when this hits sub-Saharan Africa and Asia where there are no infrastructure for public health, it's going to be a disaster. That's happening now. And the United States has abdicated its role. Trump has not just betrayed his own people, but the whole world. He pulled out of WHO. There's no model available for how to deal with this that the United States could champion, which they should be doing. It's a disaster, and that will come back to us. It spread from one continent to another. That can happen again, or else the alternative is, which is we'll never travel again.
And instead of the retweeting of scientists and people who are cautioning us and saying there should be great concern, instead we get retweets from Chuck Woolery. And I just, you know, I keep on saying, you feel like it can't get any weirder, and it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And meanwhile, people are dying and getting sick by the tens of thousands. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. If I live to be 135 years old, I will never understand this.
I'm sorry.
Who is going to defend Chuck Woolery?
He was pretty good on the Love Connection. I don't think he should just dismiss him out of hand.
Was very, very good, and I wish he'd go back doing that. And he has the right to his opinion. That is fine. I have no problem with that. But it's the fact that that is being chosen to retweet to the American people, as opposed to those in science and those in the health community who are terrified by what is happening.
Bob.
Could host the Love Connection is the question.
All right. Well, you make a point, I guess.
But you think about what Navarro did yesterday with his editorial going after Fauci. And of course, the White House is now holding up their hands, doing the polar bear salute, saying, we didn't know about it. He didn't follow the chain of command. Then you know something? The White House should be putting Pete Navarro. They should fire him today if that's the case. Yeah. If it's not
that's baloney. You know, this guy doesn't go out on his own. That's for sure.
And the one thing anything that's been said that I disagree with is, Alan, you suggested that Trump is telling people not to wear masks because he thinks it's good for his reelection. I just think it's exactly the opposite. I think that, you know, he's really shooting himself in the foot when
yeah, no, you're right. But are you telling me, Chris, not for one minute that you think that Trump isn't doing this, for political gain? He is.
Well, he's playing to a segment of his base, not even the entire base, a segment of it. And we've talked about that before, that it's really hard to figure out what exactly he's trying to do. And because, if he wants the economy open, if he wants the economy to resemble, something of its normal self by election day, he should really be urging everybody to wear masks. I mean, that's really the only way. And it doesn't make sense. It's almost like
it's almost like he doesn't want to win.
Yeah, well, I'm going to point something out to all of you one more time. He's the president of the United States. I abhor the man. I can't stand him. I think it's disgusting. I think in the end he's going to try to stay in one way or the other. But in the end, he is the president of the United States. He has made an appeal that is racist, blatantly racist, and it's working for him. At least it is, has up until now. And by no means should you count him out.
Yeah, and Chris, I gotta jump on with Alan. I think it's all about politics. I think Trump backed himself into a corner by supporting the protesters that stormed into the Michigan State House, right, with their guns to protest having to wear masks. He backed himself into a corner with the pushing to reopen, the fact that he didn't take a leadership role in the worst pandemic in modern history. I mean, I do think it is all about politics, and he continually has backed himself into a corner, and he's too arrogant to do what most normal people would do, and that's say, okay, I made a mistake, let's correct this policy and do what's right for the people.
Well, didn't he do that yesterday when he said everybody should wear a mask after tens of thousands of people have died? And there will be, I want to think of the word, but okay, schlemiels, who believe that, okay, well, he finally came around, that's good enough for me.
Yeah, but at the same time, he's retweeting the likes of Chuck Woolery, so his message, he has kind of drifted toward responsibility before, during the pandemic, and then quickly
I like that, drifted to responsibility. That's great.
And then quickly veers in the other direction. I mean, even when he was tweeting "Liberate Minnesota, Liberate Michigan," he was holding those, those daily, I don't know, briefings or whatever you want to call them, where he was trying to be more responsible. His message is just so dramatically inconsistent. And if he's doing this for political reasons, I mean, he should look at the polls, because he's bleeding older voters.
He's the president.
Are moving away.
He got to be there. He's the president.
Well,
he got to be there somehow.
Can he stay
and
there?
And he got rid of Jeff Sessions.
Yeah.
He's still got some kind of clout.
In Alabama.
Well,
so can I just
30
say,
seconds, go ahead.
Over all my years of teaching, I always taught the kids one thing. I said, if you're sitting there in a news conference and you hear something you don't know, raise your hand, because at 12 o'clock at night, you're going to be sitting there on your tuchus saying, I wish I had asked that question. Who's Chuck Woolery?
Chuck Woolery is a former game show host. He now does a lot of infomercials and let's see. What else?
He dabbled in epidemiology.
as we all do. It's been a long time since old Chuck's been on the air, but he continues to be a force. We'll continue right after this. Chuck Woolery is 79 years old. He was born in Ashland, Kentucky. He was the first host of Wheel of Fortune, 1975 to 1981. He then hosted Love Connection from 1983 to 1994. He has been married four times. His second wife, Joanne Flug. Does that name mean anything to anybody?
She invented the flugelhorn.
She is a...
I was just thinking four wives is about, he and Trump are in a competition.
Yeah. Also, and you may not know this, a little Chuck Woolery history, just a little bonus round here. He was part of a duo in the 60s called the Avant-Garde, and they had a one-hit wonder. It was called Naturally Stoned, released in 1968. So there you go. There's your Chuck Woolery history lesson on the roundtable this
morning.
Thank
you.
Yeah,
thank
you're very, very welcome. Thank you. Thank you for asking, Alan. Let me, we'll quickly get to letters.
Everybody bleach that out of your brain, please.
Turn on the lights. Joseph says, Trump may play to his base, but remember, he plays for Vladimir Putin. So not everything he does is necessarily for the base. That's an interesting point as well, isn't it?
A very good point.
All right. We then go to Jennifer, universities may lean left, but for the most part, their work is defined by rigor and accuracy. Their left-leaning appears more and more extreme as corporate, profit-driven lobbying and promotional messaging has increasingly permeated our culture, media, and government. Universities are key to holding the line in a way that looks increasingly subversive. According to the New York Times, says Dan, as of today, July 15th, the Trump administration is requiring all hospitals to report their COVID data directly to the Department of Health and Human Services instead of the Centers for Disease Control. That was the next story I was going to get to, so this is the perfect letter to bring us there. This has to do with the National Guard. They're recommending the National Guard as an option to help hospitals report the coronavirus data. The Trump administration is asking the governors to consider sending in the National Guard and sending them to hospitals to help improve data collection about coronavirus patients. The move is part of a new data reporting protocol for hospitals that eliminates the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as a recipient of that information, a decision that is sparking controversy about whether or not the data is reliable. I don't want to be scared silly by this story, but it does make me kind of scared.
It's horrifying, Joe.
Yeah, yeah.
If this works out for the government, a hard-pressed news business could, like, press the National Guard into going out and getting information for it. It's ridiculous. Is that who you want dealing with your hospital information? Bunch of weekend warriors? They're already putting down protests all over the country. We're going to add this now to their list of duties. It's nuts.
It's also really dangerous if you think about it. We've funded this amazing group of internationally renowned scientists and doctors in the CDC, and now we're not going to use them because they've been telling the truth and the politicians don't like the data. So rather than deal with the problem, what they're saying is we'll deal with the data.
Is there a problem with the data except that it shows an increase in cases, which is a problem for the administration?
Yeah, because the data shows that the policies aren't working. And this is exactly the same situation that we saw in Florida and in Georgia, where they knowingly, the governors and the governments of those two states knowingly manipulated the numbers in order to support their failed policies. Sure, go ahead.
Wait, I just want to say a word for the president and issue a sarcasm alert. You will remember that the reason we have this terrible data is because we've overtested, and now because of the testing, that is what our problem is. So now send in the National Guard. Tom Lehrer wrote a song about that once, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, philosophical level, I find the idea that it's okay for government to lie to us to be absolutely repugnant, and that's exactly what we've created in this country under this administration. And from my lips to God's ears, if Biden wins in November, the cleanup that they're going to have to do in the federal government and the federal bureaucracy is going to take the entirety of his administration. That's how much damage has been done.
It might be good to point out right now that Trump has reached the 20,000 mark in number of lies told during his administration, as recorded by the Washington Post fact checkers.
And that's why I call him a lying liar.
Yeah. Right.
And that's without manipulating the data, without calling in the National Guard to help him manipulate the data.
Chris, what's your view on this?
Well, I don't disagree with anything that's been said, but I would point out that, you know, politicians have a long history of manipulating data. It doesn't excuse it, but, you know, that's kind of par for the course, maybe not to this level. But even here in New York, you know, even here in New York, Governor Cuomo's gotten a lot of praise for his handling of the crisis, but there have been people who note that the way that the state counts nursing home deaths dramatically undercounts the number of deaths tied to the facilities, right? You know, people who live in New York know that Governor Cuomo's gotten a lot of criticism for an order that required nursing homes to take COVID patients. And, you know, the state appears to be manipulating the numbers to kind of show, to make it look as though not as many people died because of that decision as actually did. So, you know, I take everybody's point about the Trump administration. They are an extreme version of this, but you see it in governments all around.
But that's two wrongs make a right, even
no,
if it's
absolutely
true.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not. No. And, you know, I'm just pointing it out that it isn't just DeSantis or, you know, Republican governors who do it. It happens closer to home, too.
And, but this is also why CDC is so important.
Bob and then Rosemary. Go ahead.
Sure. Real quick, Rosemary. This is why the CDC to me is so important, because they know what type of data we need in order to figure out how bad the situation is. And this is why the federal government has failed in its responsibilities to coordinate during the pandemic, because they should have been putting these all into an overarching policy so that we can count the same way in New York as we do in Florida, as we do in California, so we can understand what's happening across this country. And,
right.
And instead, what we've done is that we've taken it and we've done a hit job on some of the best scientists in the world. We've elevated a bunch of keister kissing people to positions that they are absolutely unqualified for.
That would be KK.
And we shrug our shoulders at the flat out lying and deceit of a lot of our elected officials. It's a horrible situation.
Rosemary.
Well, yeah, I guess I just would echo that. It's always been the job of the media, of watchdog journalism, to guard against the manipulation of data. And what feels different to me now is not just the scale of what Trump is doing, but how coordinated it is with what Bob was just mentioning, getting rid of scientists, shutting up meteorologists at the Weather Service when they say something that's completely true, backed by scientific data, but Trump doesn't like it because it makes him look stupid, which he made a mistake and didn't want to say, I made a mistake. And that's scary. And on top of that, you have the news business at an unprecedented low point as far as resources, more people fired than ever before. So there's fewer and fewer people left to watchdog. We've had Trump shut down entire databases for things, something so simple as like abused dogs. And, you know, it's so widespread that you have to think that it's coordinated, that it isn't just, oh, God, we have an embarrassment here, let's cover it up for a while, which is more what I think is happening with Cuomo. I think you're right to point that out, though, Chris.
So, Chris, just for the hell of it, Chris, what should he have done? He should have stood up and said, well, I was following the CDC recommendations, but it was wrong. He did say that.
He wasn't following. I think he should acknowledge the mistake. I think he wasn't following CDC regulations. I mean, that's one of the things that he has claimed, but PolitiFact said that was not true.
Mm. Well, that was why I asked you the question.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know. I think the state should be honest about the policy and should be honest about how many people actually died and or got COVID and eventually died in nursing homes. I mean, I think it's crucial because we could have a second wave. As Bob knows, like you know, this data is so important, and being honest about what has happened is so important so that we can confront a second wave if God forbid it happens here in New York. You know, and that the same mistakes aren't made again.
Joe, a point of personal privilege, if I may.
Yes, sir.
We got a letter from Lynn who says, I don't understand this. Alan's conclusion for some of us, it is a push into a reckoning for physical violence. My comment is not end-mongering, which is what he meant. I have no idea what this letter is. Anybody help me here?
No.
No, I don't know.
Nope.
Okay.
We'll send it out for clarification.
Send it out for review.
Yes, exactly. Jay says, asks a very simple question. What the hell does the National Guard know about data collection? He answers the question by saying nothing. This is a dictatorship. Hospitals need to continue to submit their data to the CDC.
Go ahead. I jump in on that because I have a couple of theories. One is that that Trump's sort of knee-jerk reaction is always to put the military in into roles that it was not designed to do. And I think in part what he does that for is because he has more control over the military than he does some of the other some of the aspects of government. Now, the National Guard's interesting because it's actually a creature of the states and the governors until there's such time as a federal declaration. I also sort of read that and I sort of skeptically looked at it and said, oh, this is another thing that he wants the states to do without any support from the federal government, because as soon as the governors send the National Guard out, the states are paying for it and the federal government is off the hook. So there's a lot of bizarre elements to this.
But they did such good work in Lafayette Park. By God, please send them into.
That was unbelievable.
And you will remember, send them to collect data.
And you will remember that Eisenhower did federalize the Guard,
right?
On the desegregation issues.
Yeah. And by the way, just to get in front of the letters, we're not criticizing the National Guard. We're criticizing the use of the National Guard. Just to make
we never criticize the National Guard. We never criticize poll workers. No, we're not. I think that's really important. But the other thing too is, remember, the National Guard, just like us, these are people with families and jobs, and now you're pulling them off to do this additional responsibility. I mean, it makes no sense. It makes no sense at all. Especially when you have, I'll go back to a comment I made about CDC. We had the world's leading thinkers in public health at CDC, and we're ignoring them.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Well, can we criticize the CDC? Because where are they in this? Why are they not up there screaming about we have to have the data, and you made us hide the information about who was getting, what groups were getting this disease, and now this? They have been so compliant. I understand the president is in charge of them, but the military managed to voice its disapproval of his use of the military. Why are
not really, Rosemary. I mean, the ex-military did, not the present military. I think that's a big distinction. You know, when you're working
got up at a news conference and criticized them. The Milley did as well.
When you go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say. Go ahead.
Yeah. And the term I would have used, Rosemary, is gutless. I think the leadership of CDC is absolutely gutless. And that includes Brooks and
Redfield. Dr. Redfield.
Especially Brooks. But Redfield has been trying to acquit himself lately, as opposed to the beginning when he really was a blob on the screen.
You know, he did. I hope you're right, Alan. I know exactly what you mean. I just don't know how to read him. When he was doing the thing about the schools and he said, oh, well, we're going to send out new data. And then he comes on and says, well, there is no new data. The rules are the rules. And I thought, oh, well, good. You're standing up for it. And then he got very wishy-washy about it afterwards.
You know why he got a direct line.
Yeah, exactly.
And he did the same thing with this thing about where everybody wears a mask for 5 weeks and we'll be fine. In other words, schools could open. And, you know, most of the doctors that are being interviewed on television, on cable television, are all saying, that's not going to happen. We're way past that now.
Right. We have 2 minutes, and so I'm going to try to get through as many letters as I can. Terry says, everyone continues to talk about having a second wave. I just want to be clear that we're not going to see a second wave due to the simple fact that of this failed administration, we're not going to get out of the first wave. That is a fair point. Susan says, I think another reason for this action is that Trump is establishing the National Guard in all states in readiness for using them if he doesn't win the election and for other purposes. Carol Ann says, next step in creating a police state with a National Guard? Where's the outrage from the Congress? Chris says, my wife made a great point upon hearing this. Once you have the data, everyone and anyone can have it. They're clearly trying to stovepipe it and cover up the numbers. Thanks again. You all are on fire this morning. Anna makes a very simple request for all of us. Hey, Alabama is not a punchline. Please refrain from the elitist disparaging of groups of people. We don't have a monopoly on ideas and decency, and she is right. We will be nice to Alabama, but we are still going to ridicule Chuck Woolery.
She's right. I am guilty. I am guilty. I plead guilty to my derision for Alabama. Sorry, there'll be no change.
I am not going to say nice things about Alabama. look who they have put in and who they want to subject to go to the Senate. It's ridiculous. And Jeff Sessions is no, I don't like him either. I'm glad he's out. I don't know why he ran in the first place, but they put the failed football coach in because Trump said he'd be great. Come on.
Exactly. Come on.
Come on. Well, we're out of time. Indeed, you were all on fire this morning. Thank you very much for being so great. Alan Chartok, thank you so much. Thanks to Chris and Robert and Rosemary. You're all fantastic. We'll be back with more program after this.